Welcome, everyone. This is the April 4, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. Appreciate you all. Looks like we got a big crowd here today. Unfortunately, there's a number of things on the agenda that we will not be able to work on very much, although I will open most of them for public hearings. But we're at the point in the session where we're not getting amendments, and we're trying to work through it, and we really can't deal with them until we have the minutes, the amendments in front of it under our rules. But if you're here and you want to testify on them, I will let you do that. Let's see. We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 657, Senator Shields. So open that public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. And I'm here with my constituent, Drew Park, who's the president of Columbia Wire, to bring to you Senate Bill 657. And Drew brought this to me frustrated that his company had done its work, and because a lot of these were construction projects that could go on for longer periods of time, he was unable to collect payment in a timely fashion. So particularly in a time when we have huge unemployment problems, not only in this industry but throughout the state, I just think that it's not too much to ask that people should get paid in a timely fashion. If they have done their job and completed their portion of the project, somebody shouldn't be able to string them along for months and months on time and essentially require that the small contractor be the bank for the big contractor. So that being said, I'll pass it over to Mr. Park, and he can tell you his story, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Park. I own and operate a company in Portland, Oregon called Columbia Wire and Ironworks. We are a steel fabricator and erector that has been in business in the Portland area since 1902, and my family is the second family to own that business, so we've been around this for a while. Retention has become a big issue over the years. Retention is designed to make sure that a contractor, subcontractor, that you can keep their attention by holding some of their money for a certain amount of time. Over the years, we've seen this turn into a bigger and bigger problem in terms of getting paid the retention in a timely fashion and increases in the amount of money being retained. As a subcontractor, we work on about a 2.5% to 3% profit margin, and 5%, 10% retention puts us at a negative cash basis for a project. In many cases, the retention is not being paid out until the project is complete, which could be 6 months, 9 months, even a year after I've completed my work. Currently, I've got one project in particular I completed last August. The steel is in place, everybody's thrilled with it, and they're still holding $145,000 of my money. That's money that I could use to hire people, that's money I could use to buy equipment, that's money that I could use to show my bank I'm creditworthy. Retention is put into a category of bad debt, according to banks. So in the combination of the credit crunch, cash flow problems, this retention issue is serious, and it's really putting a hurt on a lot of the smaller contractors. We don't have the ability to hold retention from our vendors. In many cases, our projects are large material components, and so then, therefore, we're financing that 5 or 10% for the owner. So we would like to see a law put in place that limits the amount of retention to 1% and make sure that these contractors can get paid timely. We're a bunch of good guys out there doing good work, and there's no reason that our money for work that we've done should be held by the owners for an unlimited amount of time and above our profit margins. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Drew. Questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Okay, I've got about six people who want to testify on this, maybe a few more. Dan O'Brien, Dave Cutts, I think, and Nathan Phelps. I'm just going to try and bring you up three at a time to move along a little bit.
$656.
Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan O'Brien. I am a member of the Independent Electrical Contractors and the AGC Oregon Columbia Chapter. I'm a past officer in both associations. I've been working in legislative issues for quite a few years. Retention is probably my number one issue across the board. Just to reiterate some numbers that you just heard from a previous person here, our receivables are $632,000 today, $198,000 that is in retention. And it has been on projects that started as long as 9 months ago, and we don't expect to receive most of that money for at least 90 days after the project is completed, until every nut and bolt is in place. $190,000 allows us to expand our business, hire new employees, buy new equipment, which we haven't been doing because our margins are significantly less than what they were 2-3 years ago. Our average profit margin is in the neighborhood of 3%, and so at 5% retention, we're basically supporting that project for 2%, the duration of the project for 9 months. And in fact, if you look at the statistics across the board, the subcontractor basically finances a portion of that entire construction project for the entire construction project, and it's a significant percent. In our case, it's about 2% of our contract. The CFMA did a survey 2.5 years ago on a national basis to determine what percentage of retention was being held from subcontracts. The answer is 21%. So 21% of all subcontractors, whether it be heavy highway, building, or private works contractor, the average retention being held is 21%, and that money is being used to finance these projects isn't actually punitive to the subcontractors. Our process is we have a bond in place for the work we do residentially. We also have a state-mandated bond and work for work that we do on prevailing wage projects to actually pay for the prevailing any problems we have may have in paying prevailing wages. And we also have a $75,000 bond in place for the Commercial Contractors Board to ensure that we're getting our work done and it's completed in place. We think that's a good avenue for people to come out and find out if we don't get our work complete to come back and actually get money from our process and what we pay into it. We think the retention is regressive, punitive, and is subject to the whim of the individual contractor. We have some contractors that pay exceptionally well. 80% of all contractors we do extremely well with. 90% of the contractors we may have a few problems with. There's just a few bad apples out there that we need to protect ourselves from, and that's why we're here. I'm very much in favor of this bill. Thank you very much.
Dan, questions?
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Senator Beyer. My name is Nathan Phillips. I'm an electrical contractor down in Eugene, and I'm also a member of and past president of the National Electrical Contractors Association. I think that Dan did a great job of laying out the issues of retainage. We have all the same problems. Sometimes retainage is withheld on projects where we've completed our work, like the iron worker described, for months or even years before retainage is released. And we also support this bill and would like to see some equity brought into the retention process.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Committee. I'm Dave Coots. I'm with Paragon Tile, and I also represent ABC as board chair for their Government Affairs Committee. Just to reiterate again, we're all kind of walking, don't want to keep going on, but we're all walking down the same path. The one thing I want to emphasize is we're on the backside of a job, meaning we're one of the last ones on there, and we are still... I just did a couple numbers for you. The amount of prevailing wage jobs that we've done in the last several years is 43 versus hundreds of commercial, you know, non-prevailing wage jobs. And the average or the shortest amount of time that we've gone before we, you know, from our final billing to receiving retention has been 3 months. The longest has been 14, and our average is 8. As compared to the private sector, the shortest is 2 months, the longest is 13, but our average is 5 months. And we're at the end of a job. So, again, supporting the testimony of the first gentleman, years or several months is a long time to wait for a small amount of, or for a significant amount of money based on our average profit margin. I'm along with these guys. We average the same amount. And I just wanted to emphasize that really this retention issue, if there's a way to manage it, would really help our industry. And not only in, like these guys are saying, hiring and buying equipment, sometimes it's just keeping the doors open. So, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For any of the panelists, it was mentioned that most contractors are good to work with. There's just a few that are difficult. Do you take that, do your members take that into account when they're bidding work for those contractors, or do they just pass on bidding work for those contractors? I mean, to what extent is the market mechanism working in adjusting for, you know, somebody that's going to be more difficult to work for, or you're not going to get paid as soon, or whatnot?
Mr. Chair, as a senator, we are in a position today that you can't refuse any work.
Got it.
The marketplace is such that the margins are so low that you have to bid everything you have possibly in front of you, and we are probably bidding to contractors we wouldn't bid to normally. So we are taking a risk in doing that, but market realities say that that's where we need to be.
Other questions? No? Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see, Brian Craig? Let's see here, Maurice Remy and James Bellison.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Krieg with the plumbing mechanical contractors and the sheet metal and air conditioning contractors. Our contractors also have had issues over the years with retainage and the amount that is out there. It definitely cripples cash flow. It can have other impacts when you're trying to grow the business and or just keep it afloat. We're here today kind of tentatively in support of the original bill, but actually very supportive of the Dash 2 amendment, which would alter the nature of the bill somewhat. We did have a few, you know, there's discussions within the contractor in our community of the exact approach to take on this, yes. And the Dash 2 is something we can totally support.
Hey, Brian, you're referencing the Dash 2. We don't have a Dash 2.
It's not been supplied as of yet. Mr. Chair, it actually is one of the
Dash 1.
We'll get to you then. Okay. Who wants to go next?
Hi, I'm Maurice Rumming. I'm the president of O'Neill Electric. I'm also on the board of the National Association of Minority Contractors. Like what you heard earlier, we're in the same boat that a lot of these contractors are. We have over $150,000 in retention that if we had today, we'd be able to hire more people, upgrade some of our equipment, stimulate the economy. One of the things that this $150,000 represents also, just saying that we don't even receive all of it, it'd be an equivalent of $1.3 million additional into our bonding, so we'd be able to bid more projects, be able to do more work, and be able to continue keeping the doors open. The 5% is basically having us finance the project, and so when we look at it and we say we're only going to make 2% on a project, we're coming up to an agreement that we're going to actually finance it to 3%, and that money is non-interest bearing, so we're not getting interest on this 5%. And second, our banks and our bonding agents then looked at it as unreceivables, and because they're looking at it as an unreceivable, it gets wiped out, so our business actually shows a negative business model in a lot of scenarios where it should be a positive business model only because of the way the bankers and the bonders look at it, and also it restricts our ability to actually grow our business. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you. Please.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is James Faison. My company is Faison Construction. I'm a small commercial concrete contractor, and I'm here speaking in the same margin of the percentage of this 5% of this retention is 5% of my profit. I mean, we bid on 5%. That 5% is what our profit, overhead profit is. So, like, we're not like the bigger contractor where they get a big percentage of mobilization up front as a subcontractor. We don't get the money on the front end. So we have to wait to the tail end to get the money. So not only are we carrying the cost of this for 60 to 70 days out to carry all of our labor and everything before we see a check, we have to wait to the 6 months down the road, 9 months down the road before we see a real profit. So, and I think if you look at the people out there, there's no one to get paid in 60, 70, 80, 90 days. So I think it would make sense to look at it, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Any questions at this panel? Senator.
Thank you, Chair Barr. Brian, or either one of, or anybody on the panel. The dash twos, do they change the percentage at all? I mean, dropping it from 5 to 1, that seems pretty dramatic. Is there any talk of a middle value or...
Chair Beyer, Senator Giroux, the dash twos would take a little different approach. It wouldn't adjust the percentage rate. It would take an approach that contractor would be the subcontractor. The first tier subcontractor, after completing the work, can ask for the contractor to submit paperwork that would allow that sub who has completed the work to be paid off. And that would have to occur in 60 days. It still allows fair dispute process in there if there's an argument about the work. But it's a little bit simpler approach, but it does put a time frame out there so that the contractor would get paid if they have done all of the work.
The follow-up would be, now would be to the other two gentlemen, especially the middle one. You're a subcontractor. Would that take care of most of your problems then? Or do you think that you would rather have the original bill?
Actually, it would not. I mean, if you look at the time span, you know, it'd take care of some of the problem. It'd make some adjustments, but it still has kind of got a stranglehold on the subcontractor because he has to wait to see his money. You know, it'd help. It's a good help, but it still would not be enough. That's why so many small contractors are going out of business.
Okay.
If I could say something, Chair, Senator, you know, again, what's occurring to us is that because our margins are so low, that by us taking on work, it's actually causing our books actually look like they're going into a negative direction. And so that's the reason why removing it down to 1%, we'd be able to show that, yes, we are profitable to the banks and the bonding agents that at the end of the day determine whether or not we should move forward in our businesses. Without that, you'll see more construction companies closing their doors only because of that.
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was kind of along the same lines. Have you given any thought to some kind of middle ground between 5% and 1%? You've been living with 5%, I guess, for a very long time, and I'm sure the recession has not made it any easier for you. But have you given any thought to, given that you're a low-margin operation, to some maybe sweet spot where you could compromise?
Chair, Senator, what I would say is, you know, if we're going to say 2%, that would at least cause us to do a break even until we're actually paid that retention, so that way we can at least reflect to our bankers and bonders that we have a good business model. So if I was to look at the difference between the 1 and 5% earlier, gentleman had mentioned about the average being a 2.5 to 2% profit margin. So I'd look at what that profit margin is and just basically say we'll hold your profit, but we won't penalize you for taking the project.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mike Elison and John Rakowitz and Tom Gurney. Mike, do you want to go first?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Mike Elison with the Association of Oregon Counties. I just wanted to raise a few concerns about Senate Bill 657. From our perspective, holding enough incentive for the contractor to complete the final punch list or final ending cleanup items in a timely manner is critical on some of our contracts. Counties have run into this in the past. I'll just mention a couple of examples briefly, particularly with some local improvement districts where the final work involves driveway connections, cleanup work in front of existing residences. If the contractor delays in getting this final work done, can become a burden on the residents. Oftentimes, it potentially costs the contractor more to come back and do the work than the final payment amount. The contractor was to become too busy, moves on to another job. The 5% retainage is the only leverage the county has to get final completion. In our estimation, 1% does not provide the needed leverage. One other example, recent example in Jackson County, on a $2.6 million road improvement project, about a month after completing paving, there's some rutting began near the intersection, which prompted them to keep the retainage and investigate the pavement failure. The investigation revealed some errors by the testing company in that what had tested as acceptable was actually out of specification and failing as a result. The cost to correct the failure will be in the $150,000 to $200,000 range. With 5% retention, they have $130,000 of that in protection, which is enough to at least keep the contractor's attention, whereas if they had 1% retention, they'd have $26,000. In an amount that potentially the contractor could walk away from. In this case, the contractor is completely stepping up and everything should work out, but in our estimation, having that 5% is helpful and necessary. So with that, I'll close.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with AGC, Associate General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter. I think the order here is very helpful to the point of view we're going to try to bring today, and that is you heard from an owner and how they view, when they say contractor, they mean general contractor. And today you've been hearing, up until this point, from specialty contractors, subcontractors, first and maybe even second tier. So it's important to understand that chain of commerce that goes on. So we'll now talk about the next chain, general contractor, and how it works with a sub. But first, I guess I just want to speak to the bill and talk about, I've done a lot of research on this, we've had a lot of discussions internally, and this is the best I can figure out after 3 years or so in the industry is this is a decades-long, long-standing practice in law. And the bill is, as it's in its current form, I heard of amendments today, but I don't know anything about them. It will change every single contract in Oregon, residential and commercial, public and private, and doing this in a time of, this committee has heard me speak, others today, this is a full-blown depression in this industry. That's the only way to describe it. It just creates more uncertainty, and we believe will not really serve any purpose other than more uncertainty in an industry that really can't stand much more. So for those reasons, we do not support this bill. But to understand, we hope, better for the committee to understand better the purpose that retention serves, I have a member here with me today, a member of our leadership at AGC, and I'll turn that over to him. Thank you.
Hello, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Tom Girding, and I am president and owner of T. Girding Construction Company. My firm constructs commercial building projects throughout the state. However, the majority of our work is down in the central mid-Willamette Valley area. I would like to begin, in addition to that, as John had noted, I am serve on the executive committee for the board of the Columbia chapter of AGC. I'd like to begin my testimony by defining retainage as it relates to those of us who live and die within the construction industry. Retainage is a percentage of funds withheld systematically from every payment made by the owner to the contractor or from the subcontractor to the second-tier subcontractor for the purposes of assuring the work gets completed to the specified level of quality and in a timely manner, and to assure that all individuals working on the job, suppliers, providing materials for the job, and all others providing services to the job get paid. Upon completion of the project, and after the varying work items have been fully verified as being completed in conformance with the contract documents, and all individuals and suppliers, etc., have been paid, then a retainage is released and payment made to the contractor and subcontractors. While this may be a bit simplistic, I believe it accurately reflects the overall intent of retainage. As a building contractor, my firm acts both as a general contractor as well as a subcontractor. I do both. My firm is currently serving as a subcontractor on 3 separate projects and as a general contractor on 5 projects. One of these projects where I'm a subcontractor, I'm actually a third-tier subcontractor, meaning I am working for a subcontractor who is working for a subcontractor who is working for a contractor. So I understand the world of subcontracting as well. While I do not always like retainage, I fully understand and appreciate the role, actually the very important role, that it provides to our industry. And if I could share 3 examples that hopefully will help you understand why I say this. I would also like to say that in previous testimonies of my colleagues, I understand where they're coming from, and I think that this example hopefully will shed light as to where I'm coming from. As a general contractor, I was doing a project a number of years ago, and I had an excavation subcontractor. Throughout the process, we were monitoring our certified payrolls on a monthly basis. At the end of the job, project complete before retainage released, I received a bully notice, actually a claim, that the employees working for this excavator, while they had signed their certified payroll, they had claimed they had signed that under duress. In the investigation, that became verified. They had indeed signed under duress, and they had not been paid the proper wage. The excavation firm by now was out of business. I had to step up, and I had to make that payment to those employees to make sure that they were paid the correct wage, that they had not been paid. The retainage was there to help cover some of the losses, not all of the losses. The differing amount was almost $30,000 that I had to pay. However, had the retainage not been there, it would have been over $50,000. Another example is as I was functioning as a subcontractor, and I was doing a large concrete tank, again as a subcontractor to a contractor. My rebar installer had we'd been making our ongoing progress payments, maintaining our 5% retainage. The project was nearly complete with his work, and he notified us that he was going out of business. He had a small portion of work. He bought me a replacement subcontractor to assure that the balance of the monies on the project could pay for the amount of work left. I met with that subcontractor. We talked it through, and we proceeded. That original contractor went out of business. About a month later, as the project was wrapping up, I was notified by the union that he was 5 months delinquent on union benefit payments. Once again, that came to me as a subcontractor to make that payment to protect the contractor I was working for as well as the owner from a lien coming onto the project. Once again, retainage was there to assist. It did not cover all of that cost. The difference was almost $28,000 that it saved by having the retainage. The third and last example is as a general contractor, I was working with doing a project where I had an electrical firm, and it was an out-of-town project, a contractor we were not as familiar with. We tracked and monitored his suppliers. We got a list of all of his suppliers, tracked the labor, making sure those payments were being made, doing the best we could. As the project was progressing and getting near the completion, it was obvious that he was struggling. Despite our best efforts to track all of the suppliers, I think there was almost a dozen suppliers of varying ones within that. We missed one and a critical one. And in the end, there was a substantial amount due and one last time, retainage was there to assist. It would have been over $50,000 with the retainage. It was more like about a $28,000 loss. I share these examples because it shows how the retainage system, the other side of things, how the retainage system is there to help protect individuals that work for the subcontractors, as well as the varying small businesses at all levels of our industry, whether an employee, tradesperson, a supplier, a second-tier subcontractor, third-tier subcontractor, subcontractor, owner, however within it. It's an accountability system that is there to protect us all, making sure that everybody gets tied and paid in a timely basis. Today we are in a super competitive market, as my colleagues have before me have shared. Margins are razor thin and risk is extremely high. For this reason, maintaining retainage at a 5% level is a minimum and very necessary. A change in the law will bring confusion and uncertainty as different ones try to cook up their new solution to replace the leverage of retainage, which is a decade-old, tried, proven, and transparent function. That's my written testimony, and I would ask if I could just real quickly respond to some of the previous comments made. There was a reference to how the BOLI Public Works Bond is in place. In two of these instances I shared before, there was a Public Works Bond in place. The extent of that is for every Public Works project that is out there. And most of the time when this happens, it's when a subcontractor or somebody is going out of business. And if they have five or six or eight or four projects in place, it gets really quickly diluted, and that is just not enough funds to take care of it. And right now, that is the risk we're in this marketplace, is subcontractors going out of business. And that impacts suppliers as well as pensions and all sorts of things. I guess I would also emphasize that everything that the subcontractors before me have shared, while I understand that, as the general contractor side of me, we're experiencing the very same thing. We self-perform our own concrete carpentry. We have retainage withheld on us on all of those elements. Everything we have from a supplier standpoint, we make those payments. We don't hold retainage on purchase orders, so we carry that retainage as well. We experience the very same things. It sucks in this economy, but that's life. That's what we're dealing with. And I guess the last thing I would throw out there is, Mr. O'Brien, I admire very much. He's a great subcontractor and colleague, but there are contractors that I will not work for as a subcontractor. I've been there, done that, and I'm not going there again. And I would throw out that that is an extreme risk to step up and to bid anybody and everybody, and that may be part of an issue of people struggling with retainage. It is not uncommon for me to work with a subcontractor and negotiate on the front end if they do not want to have retainage to build the structure of that into my subcontract with them. So I do think there are other options, and I think they're right in saying that 80 or 90% of the general contractors out there play it very straight and work very much with them, and the best way we can make the 10% that are bad apples pay is just don't bid them and let them starve out. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Durant?
Of course. Please help me. I'm a little bit of a bonehead when it comes to some issues sometimes. But the retainage, if a subcontractor has completed his project, so the sidewalk contractor, say, and he's done, does the retainage, that doesn't get paid until after the general contractor is totally completed. Is that correct, or can he be paid the minute that when that's finalized and approved?
That retainage will be held till the end of the project unless an owner, sometimes there will be a clause where an owner at a particular stage can release retainage. But traditionally, that work will be held until the end of the project, and it can be a very long time.
Okay. Chair Meyer, if you get a chance, Brian Craig's dash twos, you might read it, because that's kind of the venue that he's going to ask to change. Once the sub is, at least my reading of it, once the sub is completed, then he could get his retainage, which kind of, if it's checked off and it's approved, I could understand why they would want that. So you might want to read that and then come back and give your opinion on the dash twos.
Could I comment to that? So one instance, and I'm not in any way saying this would be him, but past experiences with subcontractors is let's say that work is performed early on, it looks 100% complete, and however, a supplier that we are not aware of is unpaid, they have until 75 days upon completion of the project to file a claim, and so those sorts of things add, you know, sometimes we'll have up to 40 subcontractors on a project, and tracking every single one of those and all of their suppliers and all of those different things to make sure they're complete, as well as within the industry to get the design consultants, who are the owner's rep most typically, to sign off on that work all being 100% complete. This is an industry that has functioned this way, and it goes much deeper than to just be able to say they're complete and pay them off. It's extremely complicated.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you, gentlemen. Ryan, would you like to explain your dash twos, which we just got?
The record, Ryan Tribbett with PacWest, representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. Apologize for some of the confusion today, but I'd like to explain some of the background of what had happened about a month ago when Senator Shields had approached us about his bill and wanted to know where the NECA Association was on it. We took it up at the next meeting of the JLC, basically the Government Affairs Board that makes those policy decisions. There was no consensus among the group for the original bill, the moving the 5% down to 1%. They did have one potential solution, but because retainage has been a big issue and they wanted to get it something to get it tightened up, and what was unanimously approved was to is what the dash two amendment does, which says 60 days after the scope of work is complete of a subcontractor that the general can release the retainage to them. We've been working with Mr. Romming with trying to see if there's, because there was some discussion at the meeting about maybe at a certain contract level, a certain dollar threshold, it would get to the size where perhaps the retainage could get reduced down, but there was no consensus about what size that contract would be and what percentage to move it down to, if it'd be a 2.5% or whatnot. We spoke with Senator Shields about these amendments, and he was comfortable with them, I think, in part under the with the understanding that we were negotiating in good faith with Mr. Romming, and that he's invited to our next joint legislative committee meeting. He's one of our featured speakers, and we're going to continue to discuss the 5% to 1% issue and see if there's any common ground we can get to. But right now, like the first panel that came up here was actually speaking to the dash 2 amendment. They weren't speaking to the original bill, and I apologize. I thought the dash 2 had been sent from Senator Shields' office, but apparently not.
Questions? Thank you, Ryan. Mr. Rakowicz, you look like you want to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not sure if that's true, but I felt obligated. People are throwing terms around here, substantial completion of work, end of that piece of the work. The acceptance by the owner that the job is complete is the time at which everything is released, including to the GC. So we had a public owner up here just a few minutes ago, and he was saying why they held and gave a couple of examples of jobs. I'm not sure it was even bad quality work. It just turned out that particular project didn't work right. That's why they hold
retention to ensure, and until the work is actually accepted by the owner, that needs to be the standard. And I don't think that's what these dash twos are speaking to, and I think it's a really important point. Just because one piece of the job's done doesn't mean it's been tested in how the whole project has been accepted or not accepted by the owner. I guess that's my point. Thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, do you have any questions? Thanks, John. That's all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 657. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we need to put something into the record.
We have two letters, written testimony, a letter from Mark Matthews, president of the National Association of Minority Contractors, in support of the measure, and Brenda Wilson, Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, who opposes the measure.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 657. And let me see, there's a lot of people here, so I'm guessing. We're not going to move Senate Bill 766, but there are people who would like to comment on it. We have a bunch. Okay. Do I have a sign-up sheet? We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 66, and for the benefit of the audience, this has been a bill that's been evolving a lot over time as we try to get everybody to agree. The general intent was to try and find a way to bring some industrial land into the system that didn't go against cities or any other groups or anything like that, but obviously, as it happens in a legislative process, it's been going back and forth. Still an open process. If there are people who have suggestions, we'd like to hear from them. So, with that, I'm going to...
Is Steve Dean on your list?
Huh?
Is Steve Dean on your list?
Steve Dean? He does his commenting in other ways. Of course, his commenting had nothing to do with the bill, but that's neither here nor there. Jeremy, I think it's Rogers, Donna Murphy, and Robert Collin.
Go ahead, Jim.
Great. Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jeremy Rogers. I'm the project director at the Oregon Business Council, the project manager for the Oregon Business Plan. In the Oregon Business Plan 2011, we included 10 ideas to help Oregon create 25,000 new jobs a year and lift our per capita personal income levels above the national average. I'd actually like to comment both on 766 and 792 and offer support for those bills as they help advance those objectives of the business plan. Senate Bill 766 would establish the Economic Recovery Review Council to address two key issues that we identified in our process this year for developing the Oregon Business Plan. It would speed up the permitting process for industrial projects of statewide significance, and would also designate regionally significant industrial areas and protect them from conversion to other uses or reductions in their productive capacity due to local land use actions that are not required by state or federal law. The bill was developed, as Senator Beyer mentioned, from a working group that included a lot of partners, including 1,000 Friends of Oregon, DLCD, business groups, Governor's Office, Business Oregon, and some representatives from local government. And the focus has always been on how to expedite and maximize the use and development of industrial land inside the UGB. When we set the urban growth boundary, huge efforts are made to calculate the precise number of acres of industrial land that will be necessary to accommodate economic development over the next two decades. Once a boundary has been set, many local governments work hard to zone industrial land and protect it from conversion to other uses or from regulations and overlays that effectively limit its capacity. However, some jurisdictions can and do make individual decisions that effectively reduce the actual number of acres of industrial land within the UGB, and there's no feedback loop, no opportunity to reopen the UGB discussion and make up for the industrial lands that are lost to those decisions. The result is that we lose jobs and we lose economic activity because we have too little industrial land to meet demand. These solid middle-income jobs simply move elsewhere. This leaves us with struggling families here at home and fewer tax dollars for schools, human services, and public safety. These types of decisions contribute to Oregon's lackluster job and employment performance and hold us back from reaching our goals of more high-wage jobs. In the Portland metro area, We've seen multiple examples of this phenomenon in the last few years. The City of Portland's River Plan and Airport Futures Environmental Overlay Zone proposals are examples where the amount of existing industrial lands is effectively reduced. The City's decision on West Hayden Island is an example of land assumed to be available for industrial development during the UGB setting process, but then recast for other uses. An industrial zone property in Tiger that is counted in Metro's regionally significant industrial area inventory cannot be used for industrial zoned purpose. Some of the land has been frittered away with housing development, a dog park, and protests from the community to preserve trees on the site. We believe that Senate Bill 766 would help address this critical issue and ensure that lands that we count on for economic development inside the UGB are really and truly available for job creation. We'd support amendments that make the bill stronger, like allowing lands that have been identified in a comprehensive plan as industrial but not yet zoned as industrial to be designated as a regionally significant industrial area. We'd oppose efforts to weaken the bill, such as giving local jurisdictions veto authority over whether or not a tract of land should be designated as a regionally significant area. The bill already calls for the regionally significant industrial areas to be established in consultation with local governments and allows local governments to propose to the council the inclusion of an industrial area in their jurisdiction. But providing local governments with a veto power essentially undermines the purpose of the bill, so we wouldn't support that. Oregon's land use system has a precedent for limiting what folks can do on the land. We've protected farm and forest land by limiting what individuals can do on that land. Oregon has persistently high unemployment, declining personal income levels compared to the nation, and is dependent on land-intensive traded sector businesses for its livelihood. This all suggests that the state should also take some action to protect its economic development interests and prevent certain things that can be done with industrial lands. The other bill, Bill 792, creates mechanisms for a more coordinated regional approach to industrial lands. In the Portland area, Metro serves a function of coordinating multiple jurisdictions around land use planning, though it could be better tied to economic development. Senate Bill 792 sets up the opportunity for other jurisdictions to engage in a similar type of regional planning, tying economic development and land use with infrastructure investments and targeted regulatory relief. So we think 792 provides a more rational approach to planning for industrial development that happens in a regional context. Industrial development, economic development, it doesn't happen in a city context. It's really a regional phenomenon. And I understand that that bill will be, the amendments are looking at making that a pilot project in Central Oregon. We'd support that, but think that the concept really should apply statewide and hope that if successful in Central Oregon, that it would be able to be replicated in other areas as well. Now, I just want to mention that neither of these bills fully address the issues of total industrial land supply, infrastructure financing, brownfield redevelopment, and other issues that we've identified as barriers for having an adequate supply of industrial land. So we hope that either in this session or in the next session we can work with this committee to continue working on the issue of industrial land availability and address some of these other issues as well. And I think that will have a positive impact on driving up Oregon's wages and improving our employment prospects. So thank you for the time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Hi, my name is Donna Murphy. I live on Hayden Island in Portland. Committee members and chairman, thank you for your wholehearted attention. I'm glad to have it. I would just like to begin by quoting Margaret Mead, an American cultural anthropologist: never doubt this small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. West Hayden Island is being studied for annexation and industrial zoning, and the port wants to build a marine industrial terminal on top of contaminated soil dump pit that they've already called the West Hayden Island facility. We strongly oppose this industrial development, which will severely impact the quality of our lives, our environment, and our health. Now the port is trying to get their runaround tactics passed as law through SB 766 under the banner of jobs. We all need jobs. The world needs jobs. Oregon is lacking in them. Oregon has a high unemployment rate. But you can't bring this down on the backs of families and children and seniors that live in a high-impact area. We are members of an environmental justice community that could bear the risks and the burdens of industrial facilities cited if this bill becomes a law. Not allowing us to participate in a siting decision like this violates environmental justice law and policy. Excuse me. I live on West Hayden. I live on Hayden Island, right on the cove that is across from the West Hayden Island facility. To me, it is like standing at a great precipice across from what it is. It is an island sanctuary for many creatures that is scarred now by dredge spoils recklessly placed by the Port of Portland. It is a scar. Nothing grows there. I stand at this precipice and I look into my mind's eye to see what this island could become if the industrial complex steamrolls the people into submission. Gentlemen, it becomes so much easier to make decisions that affect people's lives when you remove the people from the equation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I just want to point out, though, I want to make sure that there's no confusion. The issue, you referenced the Section 6 of the bill, which talks about regionally significant industrial areas, and I'm not from Portland, so I don't know all that, but I've been told that Hayden Island is not zoned for industrial. I don't know whether that's true or not, but one of the requirements under the bill as it's written is it says it would have to be zoned for industrial.
So. Exactly. It is zoned in several different ways, and industrial zoning is included in that. From what I've read and what I've been told.
I've been told it's not inside the city, though.
It isn't inside the city.
Well, it couldn't come in, then, under this bill if it wasn't inside the city.
But it can be rezoned, and they're trying.
I guess it could be annexed, but...
Yes.
But that's not a subject of this bill. That's something that Joel would do in Portland, not something the legislature would do.
Well,
I just wanted to clarify that.
Local planning, and the process is slow, but so is democracy. You know? And we both, if we respect each other's rights, we aren't allowed to participate in this. And I'm just giving you my opinion.
I appreciate that.
Thank you
very much. Sir?
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Will Collin, or Bob Collin. I go by both. I was chair of the Environmental Justice Task Force last year, and I'm an adjunct law professor and senior research scholar at Willamette. And I've given written testimony, and I don't want to take the time of the crowds of people you have in front of you, but I do thank you for your hard work and hard times. That's what this bill shows. I parsed it very closely. I am not commenting on land use issues, only environmental justice issues. I could comment on some of the land use ones, but there's others for that. I give a quick background on what we are as environmental justice. We're both urban, and I'm very concerned with rural Oregonians and environmental justice right now. For part of this bill, it affects that. So I go on page 2, what our legislative requirement is to seek more meaningful public participation from Senate Bill 420. And I cite the provisions specifically in our legislation in my written testimony that shows what our mandate is could somehow contradict some of the other expedited processes mandates. So we have a mandate to be here and speak to this, but not to deter or stop a process that provides economic and equal opportunities for our communities. We applaud that. We need that. You've heard from the minority business enterprise people. We work with those. So we're happy with that. But the participation of individuals becomes a little bit more complicated because you get a lot of money from the federal government. And these intergovernmental revenue transfers come with federal strings, like Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and Executive Order 12898, that may shock sometimes small states like us that we don't have a CEPA, we don't have a state environmental act, so we just take it as we can find it, and we're hungry for economic development. Washington State is too. They're very powerful. They got sued for a streamlined process in Vancouver at a national case in a federal circuit court of appeals. So there's some downside risk liability that I really don't like to see because it gets adversarial. My whole shtick is collaborative approaches. That's what we won the award for. We include industry. We're not environmentalists. We're not with any of these other groups. These communities are getting boxed in and a little desperate, and they're seeking courts. So I really don't want to see that happen. Recall the spotted owl. How can we forget it? It's a challenge to economic development as we speak. 60 mills closed in low-income communities. That's an EJ issue. That's an EJ issue. The last point with land use is that, just from an EJ perspective, nothing else, is that rural municipalities, counties, subdivisions of the state are going to have a hard time on that process. It's an expensive, high-heeled process for wealthy suburban municipalities that can afford it, because that's expensive for counties to do. So some way to help rural areas to compete, yeah, they may not be regional of significance. I think they are. But they still should have the same aspect to these processes. And I'm concerned about their exclusion. The more you make it a regional priority that connects to something needed industrially, the more likely it is to have federal Department of Transportation funds involved. That held up $43 million when Seattle expanded mass transit without contemplating EJ concerns. We don't want to be a fly in the ointment. We want more jobs. But we're concerned about, and you hear from some of my constituencies about their exclusion from the processes, and they'll go to lawyers, and I don't want another lawyer's full employment act. I want to solve environmental problems in a real way that helps the private sector with long-term strategic planning. Long-term. This sunsets. That's not long-term strategic planning. And the cities, Bend, Redmond, Medford, all the cities, all the towns and villages of Oregon, to do sustainability in their planning. And I think that without the engagement of the public to help and collaborate instead of antagonize and sue, that we could go forward in a more positive way. I'd be happy to entertain questions, but there's other people here, too. I'm happy to hold them.
Thank you, Will. Questions? Thank you very much. Let's see. Deborah Heckhauser? Bob, I think that's a Sellinger? Cheryl Lunn? Are we ready?
All right. I'll start. What the heck? Hello, chairperson and committee. My name is Deborah Heckhausen, and I'm a resident of Hayden Island. And there are a couple points I'd like to bring up here. The passing of this bill will affect West Hayden Island negatively. Now, I know you told Donna that specifically that doesn't necessarily apply to what's happening with West Hayden Island because it's not industrial land. When the very first speaker who just was sitting in this chair here brought that up as a point, that the West Hayden Island is part of the securing of lands that is assumed for industrial use. So it is definitely from his own mouth lands that they are assuming belong to the industrial pool of the within the boundaries of Portland. The manufactured home community where I live is the largest manufactured home community in the state of Oregon. There's 1,300 residents, and they include low-income senior citizens. As we know, West Hayden Island is being studied for an annexation and industrial zoning. And the port wants to build a marine industrial terminal on top of their development, which will severely impact the quality of my life and the lives of the residents there and in North Portland and our health. The port has already tried to start dumping for the project under a DEQ rule called beneficial use permit that did not require any public notice to our community or a public hearing. They sidestepped the issues, which is why we're afraid of this new bill, because it's exactly what it does. We were fortunate to discover it, and we sued and stopped the process. The DEQ has temporarily pulled its permit, and the Port of Portland is no longer allowed to dump there until the process is sorted out. A recent Portland Tribune article by Steve Doohan clearly shows how the Port has been trying to manipulate the local planning process at the City of Portland. Now the Port is trying to get their runaround tactics passed as a law through SB 766 under the banner of jobs. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for jobs, and I worked for many years in heavy industrial. I am for protecting the environment, but I also understand people need jobs and industry, real jobs, not working at McDonald's, nothing wrong with that, but we need some high-paying, decent employment in this area. They're not as important as decent health and quality of life, though, if you're going to be overriding environmental justice issues in such a small community as Hayden Island. It's wrong to even consider taking away the right to public notice and an opportunity to meaningfully participate in discussion-making from the very communities that will bear the burdens of those industrial facilities. And it's wrong to limit our legal right to challenge a decision that violates our rights. We are members of an environmental justice community that could have to bear the health risks and burdens of industrial facilities cited if this bill becomes a law. Not allowing us to participate in a siting decision like this violates environmental justice law and policy. Local planning process may be slow, but it's worth a consideration. We need to find out how this impacts our areas. In my personal opinion, I think Hayden Island is at saturation point with what it can bear. I don't know if you're familiar with the island at all. And in looking at the Port of Portland, of course, they have a rich history of future planning. I believe that the use of Hayden Island is an unreasonable objective for a healthy and viable port. The island is extremely small, extremely narrow, and in the short term may be the most cost-effective spot to choose, but as far as a growing and sustainable port, the island, this is going to be a short-lived endeavor, and at what cost? I just don't think it's the best plan, that choice for the new port. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon Society. if this bill were simply about preventing land conversion, industrial land conversion through rezoning, we would support it. We supported that in the past. It's in the Portland River Plan. We think industrial land should be protected from conversion to other uses, but this bill goes far, far beyond that. You could accomplish that objective in a couple of paragraphs. This bill goes on for pages. We're concerned about the process to date, the closed-door atmosphere in which this was developed, the industry-driven atmosphere in which this was developed, and the fact that it remains exclusive, it's still exclusive of conservation interests. We requested at the last hearing participation. We weren't invited. We weren't notified of the hearing. This is basically an industry bill. We're concerned that this bill uses the recession as an excuse to roll back public process, roll back local oversight, and to prevent new environmental regulations. The recession wasn't caused by environmental protections, local oversight, and environmental protections. The recession was caused by the fact that we had inadequate oversight of certain industrial sectors that were then allowed to run amok. It truly would be an ironic lesson from that if this recession was used to roll back public oversight and environmental protections. We have several specific concerns. First of all, the mitigation requirements. This bill clearly would inhibit new environmental regulations. We keep getting told that, well, it won't roll back existing environmental regulations. That's all fine and good, but many of our existing environmental regulations are 25 years out of date. Many of them are insufficient. You only need to look at Portland Harbor to see that. By requiring that municipalities mitigate for new environmental protections or other regulations with land that's very similar to the land that's being impacted, you'd effectively prevent any new environmental regulations from going into place. We're concerned about the buffering requirements, which takes control out of the local jurisdiction's hands. We're concerned about the loss of local control. The projects of statewide significance basically become state decisions rather than local decisions, and we think that's inappropriate. We support streamlining, but streamlining that's truly inclusive of the state, the feds, and the local municipality, where everyone's at the table, not where one sector dominates. We're very concerned about the lack of public involvement, and for a bill that started out about preventing land conversion, we question how it could have possibly gotten to a point where it bans public hearings, limits notice, and limits appeals to the extent that it does. That, to us, is perhaps the most problematic part of this bill, along with the environmental restrictions. So we'd encourage you to really take a close look at both of those. We also understand that several of the organizations involved in drafting this bill want to be able to include non-industrial lands that as our regionally significant industrial areas. That would include places like West Hayden Island that you're hearing about. Regardless of whether that happens or not, the fact is that once a place like West Hayden Island or Portland Harbor or the Columbia Slough is designated as a regionally significant industrial area, it would cut out public process and it would reduce the local municipality's ability to protect the environment and the local communities. We've been told, don't worry, because the amended draft won't be as bad as the original, but we haven't seen the amended draft. We've seen a few versions of it that have slipped out, but the fact that it won't be as bad as the original is no consolation. The original shouldn't be the baseline. The original, from our perspective, was one of the worst environmental bills we've seen in a decade. What should be the baseline is the current ability of the community to be involved in the public process and to regulate these lands, and how this moves forward or backward from that. In our opinion, this moves significantly backward, and none of the drafts that we've seen change that opinion. So we would encourage you to reject this bill. We'd encourage you to bring back a bill that actually deals with the original issue at hand, which is conversion. And again, we could support a bill that doesn't allow for that prevents conversion of industrial lands. We can't support a bill that rolls back public involvement and restricts environmental protections. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee members, for your careful consideration about Senate Bill 766. And I, too, am a resident of West Hayden or Hayden Island. I'd love to be a resident of West Hayden Island because it's 826 acres of absolutely beautiful wildlife habitat and could be used for nature-based recreation, and a lot of great things could happen with West Hayden Island. But anyways, my name is Cheryl Lund, and I live on the river, and I'm actually surrounded by industrial land, whether it's been zoned industrial yet or whether it will be zoned industrial. But I look across at Delta Park. I'm across from Kelly Point Park. I'm looking at North Portland, living on the island. I'm surrounded by industrial land. And I think what bothers me most about this bill is when I hear that my voice may not be heard. Again, I know many of us, you know, from the island have talked about it. I've spent 4 years trying to stop something happening to industrial land, and hundreds of hours. And this isn't my job. I have a job that I do besides this. It's become a job. And the thought that my voice is not going to be heard or could not be heard if the industrial lands across the river from me are developed with who knows what, I don't know. That's what I'm worried about, is if I can't voice, if I don't have a voice in saying, speaking to what might be developed across the river or on the island where I live, that worries me. Expediting permitting for large industrial projects, I feel, is exactly the opposite of what you should be considering. look at Deepwater Horizon. That was expedited. I mean, that created the biggest oil disaster on this planet. Expediting large industrial projects needs extra care, needs extra time, needs more people involved. And like has been said before, yes, and that is democracy. And yes, that slows things down. But that's what Oregonians do. That's how we've made this. That's how this state has stayed as beautiful as it has. It's because there's been public process. I feel like using the jobs issue, and of course, as been stated before, I have a job. I mean, I want it, you know, I believe, of course, everybody wants jobs. They want good jobs. But using jobs to ram through a bill that takes away the citizens' rights to the public process, that doesn't help anybody, whether they've got a job or not. And then finally, I would say that that this legislation could potentially reverse 40 years of local implementation of state land use policies. And I urge you to please reconsider and reject Senate Bill 766. I don't think it's good for the people of Oregon. I don't think it's good for Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions at this panel?
Thank you very much.
Let's see here. Martha Pellegrino, Susan Anderson, and Tom Armstrong.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Hello, Martha.
For the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I'm going to be very brief today and then reserve the primary part of our testimony for Susan Anderson, the Director of our Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. First, though, I would just like to clarify a couple things for the record. First, I would like to acknowledge the Governor's leadership on legislation that will aid in Oregon's economic recovery. It is a great goal and one that is shared by the City of Portland. I also, Mr. Chair, want to acknowledge your efforts to bring the city in on the discussions. We participated in the last few work group meetings and just want to say thank you for keeping your door open and for being willing to work with us on these concerns. My understanding is today our comments are going to be focused on a work group draft that was circulated on Friday, so I understand that in the process this is not a final draft. It's a discussion draft, and that's what we'll be discussing. So without further ado, I'd like to turn things over to Susan Anderson.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Byer, members of the committee. My name is Susan Anderson. I'm the planning director for the City of Portland. We've submitted written testimony, so I won't go into too much detail, but I do want to touch on some of the highlights. The main one being that for more than 150 years, Portland has been the industrial center. And for more than three decades, since the 80s, we've adopted very strict industrial sanctuary limits. And we think that those are incredibly important. And with this in mind, we support the objective of the bill that we want to protect the lands that are zoned industrial for industrial uses and for job creation. However, we do find ourselves in the position of having to not be in favor of all of the parts of the bill. Overall, we believe that Senate Bill 766 hurts our ability to address the challenges that we face to create a vibrant economy in our industrial areas. And it does that because it will lock in outdated regulations that we do not really believe that either that the outdated regulations do not serve industry and they do not serve the residents of our community. We'd like to refer to just four issues quickly. The first one is the mitigation and replacement language in Section 7.2b of the draft work group amendments. This language is too restrictive and effectively prohibits landlocked cities like Portland from adopting new land use plans or development standards. We must have more realistic options to mitigate any impacts of land use regulations. Again, Portland's a landlocked city. We don't have control over the urban growth boundary. A rezoning of commercial land or rezoning of residential land to comply with the mitigation requirement won't work. It's not an economically viable alternative. Industrial uses just can't afford to go and buy commercial or residential land to move into. So our goal is to have other options to be allowed for mitigation. Our goal is to improve the situation for industry, especially in the harbor. This is the state's marine industrial land. It's the heartland, really, for the state. But the draft amendments, as they're written, would just lock in the old Willamette River Greenway Code. That's a code that, you know, it's 30 years old. Industry has told me directly for years they're not happy with that. They it's not what's best for harbor industries. They've expressed dissatisfaction with it, requested amendments. We've worked very closely with them. If we want to make updates to that code, we now understand that that won't be possible under this current bill. And if we do make changes, we really know that we'll seriously risk litigation from all sides. So my written testimony will outline some of those things. Some of the options that we're looking at are increasing the intensity of development, increasing the productivity of land. We have to remember that this legislation isn't really just about land. It's about the jobs. We don't just want more land for land's sake. We want to have more jobs per acre. We want more jobs and productivity because of this legislation. Our second issue is related to the federal exemption language that's in Section 7.3b. It's a step in the right direction, but we ask that the committee make clear in the record that it is intended to allow the city to respond to their federal rules with appropriate regulations. Whether it's the Endangered Species Act or whether it's FEMA flood insurance, we want to make sure that we can respond to those regulations and not have this be an impediment. Our third issue is that we're very concerned about the draft amendment language in Section 7.2a.b. that would preempt new non-industrial uses that are adjacent to designated regionally significant industrial areas. The adjacent to language replaces previous language, which was about buffering lands adjacent to industrial sites. The draft amendment removes a lot of our flexibility. A lot of what we do at the local level is working together with government, with industry, with the community to avoid or minimize different conflicts. We don't want to have just stringent rules that are handed down to us with no flexibility so that industry and the community can't work together. Lastly, I want to focus on regionally significant industrial areas. The bill defines those as areas that would include only planned and include sites that are only planned and zoned for industrial use. We agree with that. The city opposes any expansion of this definition to areas that are not zoned for industrial use. Such a change would undermine our local efforts to expand the supply of industrial lands and could make Metro UGV expansion discussions even more horrendous than they already are. So I thank you for this opportunity to share our thoughts. Again, the City of Portland, like many of the people who are here, we are definitely in favor of protecting land that is already zoned industrial, and we don't want that to shift to commercial. We don't want to see it shift to other uses. We want to see it remain for industrial jobs. But we also urge your opposition to provisions that would unintentionally undermine the kind of work we're trying to do at the local level. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tom Armstrong. I am planner with the City of Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm just here to answer any questions that may come up today.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, we're all trying to get to the same place. And when it comes to the city's efforts to preserve industrial land and keep it from reverting to other uses, do you see a need at all for a statutory assistance in that area? And if so, what direction would that take to actually help you without causing some of the problems that you pointed out?
Well, you know, currently we don't know that we need more help in terms of keeping our industrial land industrial. We think we've done a good job of that. there's certain areas, this bill in particular, there's some unintended consequences, I think, of things that could happen, where our goal is jobs. It's not industrial land, per se, just for industrial land's sake. And so a good example of an unintended consequence would be at the University of Portland. So they're a huge employer for us. They want to expand. And they need to expand on two parcels. One of those parcels is already in zoned employment land. It's not industrial. But another parcel is industrial land. And as part of this bill, I know that's not what you were trying to do, but they couldn't make that shift. And they need to make that shift in order to expand their campus. It's on land that is a former Superfund site. The EPA has said that it's not, it's indicated because of transportation and a lot of other reasons that site's not a good site for industry anyways, and it's something that we would want to be able to do at the local level. So I can't think of real specifics where we need the state's help to protect our industrial land.
Mr. Chair, to follow up, you say, I think you raise a good point about it's not really about the land, it's about what you do on the land and getting the jobs. If the University of Portland were to be held back from this, have you figured out what impact that would have on jobs?
I don't have that number here, but I'm happy to get that for you, yeah.
Okay, but it would have a negative impact on
absolutely. Job creation. The focus was on growing some of their new departments and soccer, you know, which we don't want to think of that as you don't want to waste soccer in industrial lands, but both are job generators, and that's a part of that package.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Thank you very much.
Let's see here. Linda Ludwig and Wes Hare.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, and I am not from Hayden Island. I'm from the League of Oregon Cities. I really appreciate a couple of minutes to talk to you today about 766. Cities in Oregon absolutely realize the importance of jobs in their communities through business recruitment, retention, and expansion. Over 80% of the state's jobs are within city limits. This is a really kind of a little-known data piece. And over 80% of the state's income tax dollars are generated inside city limits. I'm not talking about inside UGBs here. I'm talking about inside city limits. So cities are very highly aware of their role in stimulating economic development for the state's recovery, but also for their own local recovery. We have a couple of concerns with Senate Bill 66, and we just want to briefly talk about those today, the largest being the potential for the reduction of local decision-making in the designation portion of the bill, the designation of regionally significant industrial areas. The project portion of the bill for project permitting has that there, the resolution for a local jurisdiction of support. We also believe that the designation section of those regionally significant areas should also have that accompanying resolution of support from the city whose jurisdiction the designation would be within. To that end, we encourage the committee to consider and pass the -3 amendment, which I passed out to you today. Which would require a resolution of support for those designations. That's all it would do. There are several cities that I've spoken to in the last week that would consider a request with the -3 for a designation. And there are some significant acreages that those cities, those parcels could bring into play. We think that amendment is very important given the size of the sites that can be designated under the bill. They're very small, down to 10 acres, with a accumulation of multiple sites of at least 30 acres. That's a pretty low threshold in terms of acreage size. Also, the bill, under the bill, sites cannot be undesignated for at least 10 years. That's a very long time if the designation is underutilized, not utilized, or unserved with infrastructure. Which brings me to the last point that I'd like to make. In the majority of the state, it's the lack of infrastructure and infrastructure funding to serve the sites that's the largest burden from our perspective, not the regulatory burden that we're talking about here within in the bill. We believe the bill should be amended so that this, when and before a site is designated as a regionally significant area, a financing plan should be developed that identifies needed and necessary infrastructure for the site, if it doesn't have it already, and identifies how that infrastructure would be funded. So with me today is Wes Hare from the City of Albany to spend a couple of minutes talking about his experience within industrial siting with his city.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My story, if you will, is about an industrial site located within the city boundaries of the City of Albany. It's roughly 250 acres. It's been zoned for industrial use for, I think, over 30 years, probably since plan acknowledgement. And there, the question in Albany isn't a question of preserving the land for industrial use. It's being able to make use of land that is appropriately zoned and was in, has always intended to be used for industrial purposes, but faces some significant hurdles. Probably the biggest hurdle is just time. We actually did have an industrial client that chose this site to do a major project. And with that particular client, we were fortunate in that they had a fairly long timeline and that they were able to go through an extensive wetland permitting process, and they were also able to work with the Department of Transportation on some transportation issues and were able to at least proceed with the planning phase of their project. Unfortunately, their market changed, they were unable to complete the project, and they had to terminate it. The problem we face is that any prospective client faces a two-year hurdle in trying to be able to break ground on this particular site. And it's been my experience over a long career as a city administrator in Oregon that most companies that are looking to locate in your community don't want to wait 2 years. And I see some hope from this bill. I certainly, you know, share some of the concerns that Linda raised regarding local participation in the process, and I'll confess to being, you know, the flea on the back of the elephant in terms of having a statewide perspective. But I can tell you that having a process, a mechanism for expediting industrial opportunities, I think, is a very good idea, and one that I hope you'll pursue and be able to work through some of the concerns that folks have raised.
Mr. Hare, I'll tell you that at least my interest in the bill, when we started, was getting at the one that you talked about, where a lot of times the issues are not so much the land use per se, but it's getting some of the state agency permits expedited and getting the state agencies coordinated. And that was sort of the direction that would allow that to happen, so that you at least have it happen. While I understand a lot of the concerns of people from the Portland area, it really wasn't intended to be a Portland bill, but certainly I understand and appreciate their concerns about it.
Yeah.
Well, it was both the city and the residents of Hayden Island, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the specific problem in Albany is we have this parcel of land where someone actually went through the entire wetlands permitting process over 2 years. I believe they told me over $100,000. That expired, that work expired in August. A new client will now have to go through the entire process again. And that just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Senator Burdick.
I just was wondering whether you've had a chance to look at the Dash 3 amendment and if that is something that you think would be useful.
I have not seen the amendments, and I apologize.
That was
the League's amendments. Okay, other than just getting a briefing from Linda, I really haven't studied them, but I'm supportive of the League's amendments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, City of Salem.
Good Mr. Chair, members of the committee, hi, I'm Sean O'Day. I'm the Deputy City Manager for the City of Salem. It's our pleasure to be here today to testify on this bill, and we appreciate that it is still very much a work in progress. With me today is John Wales, our Interim Urban Development Department Director, whose department is chiefly responsible for the city's economic development, economic recruitment efforts. And I also have Vicki Harden-Woods, our Community Development Director, who's chiefly responsible for our land use planning program at the City of Salem. As a city that is dedicated to improving the employment opportunities within our community, we truly appreciate the intent behind Senate Bill 766. And we appreciate that it is still very much under development. We believe we have expressed some of our concerns about this bill, specifically concerns focused on local government preemption, the lack of clear standards and guidelines for decision timelines for the state to make, the ability to accommodate confidentiality perspective development opportunities that we have found in our experience to be something that is critical in the area of economic recruitment, that is to say, to keep proposals by prospective developments confidential and to allow that to work its way silently through the approval process, allowing the company to disclose who they are at the appropriate time that meets their business needs, as well as the ability to satisfy potential infrastructure needs, which I think Ms. Ludwig touched upon being really, in our experience, the number one hurdle to economic development is having adequate infrastructure to serve the site. So with those concerns in mind, and as you move forward with this bill, what we would ask is that, one, you support the Dash 3 amendments. We do believe that local buy-in on a project, whether it be a project base or an area based, within this bill is very important. We'd also ask that you give deference to local governments in the land use planning decisions that are to be made. Under the current bill, as we understand it, the state council will make a lot of decisions that would otherwise be at the local government level. Certainly, we recognize that there's going to need to be a certain degree of collaboration between the state and the local government, but we would ask that the bill be specifically amended to provide that those local government recommendations be given deference in that council's determination. We also, with respect to the part of the bill that talks about projects of statewide significance, where there's the appeal provision currently provides that a party who feels as though there's been an unconstitutional decision would have standing to appeal, a party that has participated in the proceeding. We believe that standard should be broadened to include a decision that is contrary to local law or a decision that would be contrary to the facts. It's limited just to decisions that the prospective appellant thinks is unconstitutional. We think could lead to inconsistent decisions between those that the council is making and those that a local government would have made on those same facts presented to them. We appreciate that there's been some interest in having a local delegate, a representative on the council for those decisions on a statewide project of statewide significance, or in designating an area, having a member of that local government present on the council to make those decisions and to have a vote with that. We truly appreciate that. As you go forward in exploring that concept, we would ask that you allow the local government to designate who that individual would be, whether it be in a local elected official, a planning official, city manager, or city manager's designee. We believe that it should be the local government's choice in who to place on that council. Also, to ensure that the industrial areas that are designated by the council have sufficient infrastructure to serve them, we would ask that the committee consider amending the bill to provide for the requirement to create what we would call an infrastructure plan, a plan that would identify the infrastructure that would be needed to serve those sites, as well as identifying, not necessarily committing, but identifying where the potential funding sources might come from to meet those infrastructure needs. And finally, with regard to the provision that once an area is designated, local government shall not make changes to their local land use regulations without a mitigation requirement, we would ask that there be some form of relief to that if a local government is able to make their case to the commission for a particular amendment that we feel would advance jobs. You've had one example already where we think that such a provision would be applicable, specifically because we really are focused on jobs. Occasionally, we will have development opportunities that are looking at industrial land. that the land use, current land use zoning would be incompatible. But if we were able to bring that company in, we would be bringing jobs to our community as well as to the state of Oregon. And we feel that the way that the bill is drafted right now would prevent us from being able to move around with that zoning designation, at least not without a mitigation requirement. In those special cases, we would ask that we'd be able to take that such a case to the committee and have the committee weigh in and say, yes, in this case, city, we are fine with you rezoning that property, and you don't have a mitigation requirement because of the jobs that this particular project would bring. With that, and in the interest of time, we'll conclude our comments, and Mr. Wells and Ms. Harden-Woods are here to answer any questions you might have.
No one else? Great. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a comment before at the end. Are we at the end of the
No, we still have a couple other people.
Well, I'll make comments now before we start losing people. I no longer feel bad about having the seed bills before a committee, but I do want to say to the citizens who came from Hayden Island, I appreciate that you have come all the way down here and taken time. And I also sympathize with the frustration you feel in the process. This is Oregon's holy grail, land use. And for everything that has been your concern in the part of Oregon that I represent, people feel that land use stops anything from happening. And that there's so much public process that good ideas skip my part of the state altogether. So I appreciate you coming, and I know from the looks on your faces that you're frustrated. As a veteran of this particular issue, I'm not sure what the exact best public policy is, but I do know that your voice has been heard today, and we'll go into the hopper.
Thank you very much. And the last two, John Killen and Mary Kyle McCarty.
Should be on.
Oh. Did I miss somebody? If you'd like to speak, come on up. Huh?
Is she saying this one? Is she under 792?
Oh, you're under 7. You're interested in 792?
No, 766.
Signed up on a different one. That's okay. Come on up. I apologize for that.
Well, I apologize.
This is.
Good afternoon. Oh, please.
Much of what I was planning to say today has been said more than once, and in the essence of time and my meters out of money, I thought I would save you some of that, but I have not edited this down because I couldn't listen to what everyone had to say and do that. Just a couple of points, I think. We all know that SB 766, thank you all of you.
Could you put your name on the record, please?
Carol Lee Collin. 766 threatens to take away all public participation and appeal rights for communities potentially impacted by industrial land uses and facilities. I think that most of my points have been made today, but we're in a very unique situation there in our community. It's quite large. We don't own the land, we own the units on it. At this point, no one is able to sell anything. You cannot move them off the land. You don't. They're old. They're not going anywhere. They would fall apart. We have a very high percentage of elderly and handicapped people on the island that get around literally by motorized carts and such. How does this impact all that? It does. I love my island, and we all need to be heard. I'm here today for hundreds of people. I didn't want to come. I had to take off work. I found out about this last night. But I feel like I'm a voice that all of us that do manage to get here are voices for the many people who can't come. We need our thoughts and our considerations known, and you have already heard those today, but hurrying along legislation like this only serves those people that are in it for monetary gain and industrial purposes. So it needs to be a fair decision on whether to to go against this or to be for it. We are being considered for annexation. I just think the very word justice. I wanted to look that up on the drive here. However, I was driving, so I couldn't. And environment. These are really, really important things. And the people of Hayden Island are greatly impacted already by things that have nothing to do with this. We are in over our heads with all of the things going on, with the interchange and just dozens of issues. So I'm just asking you to please consider being as fair as possible by, let's don't have this bill go through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Appreciate you sticking around late this afternoon. My name is John Killen. I'm representing both the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest Chapter of Associate Builders and Contractors. As you all know, these are two groups representing hundreds of merit shop construction contractors eager to see job creation in Oregon. The last speaker just mentioned monetary issues. Absolutely. From our perspective, there's about 100,000 construction workers and manufacturing workers that would sure like to get back to work and have some monetary issues to deal with. On a personal note, and then I'll be very brief and quit, I live in Tualatin, about 10 blocks from a pretty good percentage of what's left of industrial area in the metro area. Please, bring the jobs, bring the development, please. We'd love it. On a even more personal note, Senator Beyer, the site in Albany that they worked so hard to get was a passion of my late father's. He was the mayor of Albany at that time, and so I really appreciate you kind of dedicating some of your efforts on this bill towards that. I really do. Finally, to close, we agree with the proponents of this bill that the efforts need to be made. We need to streamline. We need to cut back in some way to get some jobs going. And I appreciate the temporary nature of the bill as it kind of sits. It's a good way to get us some fast streamlined construction going. We appreciate that very much. So we ask that you keep up the effort.
Thank you. Any questions? Excuse me, Senator Gerard.
Yes, I'd like to take a shot at the people from Hayden Island. And first of all, I'd like to say thank you for coming. I love your passion. I love everything you have to say. And for God's sakes, fight the annexation. I wouldn't want to be part of Portland either.
Thank you, Senator.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy from 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm going to just address two points because I know that there are amendments coming out of Legislative Council that aren't here yet. First of all, we supported the concepts in the bill that were presented to this committee on March 10th, which is not the same as the original bill. And I think that's important for a lot of people to understand that bill that was presented to you at your March 10th hearing addressed the standing notice and public participation issues that were of real concern in the original draft of the bill. And so I think it's important for people to know that those provisions have been changed, and they should look for those in the bill that will be coming out of Legislative Council, because those are real issues, and those have been changed by the working group, by Senator Beyer. The second issue is an issue that has also been in the bill all along and we're concerned might have been taken out in what was submitted to Legislative Council. I'm only going to briefly touch on it because we'll all see when that comes back out. But it relates to an issue that you've heard several of the cities and the League of Cities talk about, which is to provide an opportunity to focus on employment potential and not just employment land. And in the bill draft that was presented to you at your March 10th hearing, in Section 7, there were two provisions for ways in which a reduction in potential industrial land could be addressed through the addition of more industrial land that qualifies as regionally significant industrial areas, or through other things that would increase the potential of the employment potential of the existing regionally significant industrial areas. We think that's an important policy concept to continue moving forward
not looking only at land, but also looking at employment potential and job potential, and providing local governments the opportunity to break down some of the barriers to use industrial lands more efficiently. So I just wanted to flag that concern for you, and we'll all be looking at the Legislative Council's draft when that comes out.
This panel?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is everybody I had signed up on 766. I did not have on 792, so let me ask one more time. Is there anybody who wishes to testify on 766? Seeing none, let me just comment before I close that this is, I know it's frustrating if you're not familiar with the process. This is something that started before I was elected to office last November, and people have been working on trying to figure out a way to make this happen. It is not intended to be a Portland bill or Hayden Island bill. The intent that we've been working on is to not be inconsistent with local governments, but it's viewed, we use the term permissive legislation, which would mean if a city wanted to do this, they could propose it, and it was a way to make it a little more expedited, although the public noticing requirements that are in the bill are the same that's in statute now. The appeal process is a little expedited, but the noticing requirements are the same as that's in existing law now, so there's no attempt to go around that. I can't comment on your relationship with Portland. That's between you and the county and the city up there. That's not our issue. You know, we don't. The state legislature doesn't deal with land use zoning, just the general parameters, so I'll leave that to you. There are amendments that have been, there's a number of amendments that have been proposed by different things. It is my personal policy as chair of this committee, if somebody has an amendment, I'm more than happy to give you a note to go down to Legislative Council and have an amendment drafted, and it will be considered if someone wants to propose it. Process is open, contrary to comments. It's not intended to be closed. It's just a matter of, you know, knowing who to notify. There's probably been 75, 80 people that have been in and out of this process over the time. So it's not intended to be closed. It's just a matter of knowing who's who. And certainly I understand that there's no way that you folks on Hayden Island would know that. I don't know that, but the city of Portland has been involved, city people, a thousand friends and some others. So we try to get the people who are generally involved in the process, involved in this one, because that's the way we try to do legislation, is to balance it out and get everybody involved. Doesn't always work, but we try. So, again, so with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 766 and open public hearing on Senate Bill 792. Do we have anybody, has some people who wanted to testify? Again, we don't have the amendments. Doug, if you're signed up.
No,
Mr. Rogers already did testify.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of Central Oregon Cities. I just wanted to say, because I've been asked a number of times by people in the building and outside of the building about the general application of this bill. As drafted and introduced, it applied statewide. The amendments that we have in process would apply it only to what we've been discussing with DLCD and ODOT, which is a Central Oregon three-county pilot project. So that's the effort. And so if anyone is listening or in the audience, it will not apply to any area outside of that Tri-County area, and it is part of a collaborative process that we talked about last hearing. So just thought that might be helpful to a few people, and I'll be able to answer questions when the amendments arrive. Thanks.
Anybody else? If not, we will close on public hearing on Senate Bill 792, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 935, Richard.
Senate Bill 935 provides judgment debtor with increased exemption from execution of tools, implements, apparatus, team, harness, or library that is necessary to carry on a trade, occupation, or profession from $3,000 to $5,000. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We heard this bill on 329.
There are no amendments?
No amendments.
Okay, the chair moves Senate Bill 935 to the floor with a due pass. Discussion. Is there any objections? Senate Bill 935 is moved to the floor with a due pass. And who wants to carry that?
We have Senator Devlin as the sponsor.
Okay, let's ask him if he wants to carry it. How about 506? Okay. Okay, that's it for the day then, I think. So is there anything else to come before the commission? We will take the rest of these up on another day. We are adjourned.
What's your sonar carrying moment?